Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello and welcome to MASHcast, the show that analyzes and celebrates episode by episode the greatest TV series of all time, MASH, which aired on CBS from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fine Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, General Robert Iron Guts Kelly. And joining us this week in the VIP tent is Captain Marie Kay. Hi, Marie. Welcome back.
Hi, Rob. Thank you so much for having me back. I am so excited to talk to you and to get to talk about this great episode and to be Captain Marie, because that sounds like a superhero. My goodness.
You deserve it. This is your second appearance. You absolutely deserve it. Of course, you were on last season talking about Inga, and that was a really fun talk. And you've always been an amazing commenter on the website. And so I was really looking forward to talking to you again. So we are here to talk about the 14th episode of season 8, Stars and Stripes. The original air date was December 17th, 1979, written by Dennis Koenig, directed by Harry Morgan. There's a name we don't always hear in the directing chair, but here he's directing this episode. Since Marie has been on the show before, we'll get right into the plot. With no wounded to care for, everyone at the 477th is bored to tears, but at least two of the staff have something to do. BJ and Winchester have been asked to write a paper for the American College of Surgeons after the successful recuperation of a patient they both worked on several weeks ago. Everyone is impressed, none more so than Winchester himself, who takes this event as an opportunity to talk about himself in the most glowing of terms. This leads BJ to fight for his own turf, and their attempt at writing the paper quickly devolves into an argument, each doctor refusing to budge. With Hawkeye excluded, he's even more bored. He's thrilled, though, when Scully arrives back in camp, but Scully has to remind Hawkeye that, as entertaining as Hawkeye might be, he's here to visit Margaret. Hawkeye is aghast. You'd rather spend time with a voluptuous blonde than a pale, skinny brunette? Margaret is happy to see Scully, but like Winchester and BJ, it quickly dissolves into a fight when Scully reveals his lack of respect for Margaret's rank, insisting that she, quote, gets the boss around a bunch of women, somehow insisting that she's not a real major. Margaret protests, and Scully storms out. Margaret, after a talk with Hawkeye, decides to try again with Scully. She has Klinger help tailor her a dress, a very feminine, puffy pink outfit, and she's wearing it in her tent when she has Scully visit her on Klinger's orders. Scully's a lowly private at the moment. At first, Scully loves it, but within a few minutes, their inherent differences come to the surface. Scully starts treating Margaret like a handmaiden, asking her to cook him an omelet and promising that after a romp with him in the sack, she'll be a new woman. They both realize that, as a couple, they just aren't compatible. Scully wants to be in charge, no questions asked, and can't abide a woman as strong and independent as Margaret. They decide to end their relationship such as it is, and Scully heads back to his unit. Meanwhile, the fights between Winchester and BJ get so bad, they decide to write their own papers and let Colonel Potter decide which of them is the most accurate. When Potter gets wind of this, he sits them both down and reads them the Riot Act, reminding them both that it was a group effort. The other doctors, the nurses, the staff at Walter Reed that helped pull the young man through. BJ and Winchester, humbled, decide to rewrite the paper, crediting it to the entire staff of the 477th. Later, Margaret meets Hawkeye again in the Oak Club for some drinks, and she tells him that Scully is gone for good. She talks about the kind of man she wants to meet, who is 20% her father, 10% Scully, 10% Hawkeye, 3% Frank Burns, and 2% her ex-husband. She then reconsiders and says, 1% of my ex-husband. Hawkeye tries to cheer Margaret up over a game of Scrabble, realizing that they're two people looking for an exact fit in an off-the-rack world. All right, now, Marie, you asked for this, and this was on your short list of ones you wanted to talk about. I got a hunch that there is one of the two plot lines that you're more eager to talk about than the other one.
You might be right there, yes.
Okay, all right.
When I sat down and really went through this episode in preparation for this, I was like, oh yeah, BJ and Charles are also present. Good for them. Interesting. But yeah, it's definitely Margaret's side of the story that drew me to this episode for sure.
Okay. So before we get into the details of it, what is your overall feeling about, do you get a hunch that, I mean, we'll never know, but do you get a hunch that this, the end of the Scully thing, was maybe on the direction of Loretta Swit, and that it was like, look, I don't want to be saddled with yet another guy. Like, I want to have some other storyline. So can we wrap this up? Because it feels a little abrupt overall. I think that like it seemed like they were getting along, although there was some other dialogue in the previous episode that we can get to that I think maybe is seeding this idea that Scully is, not quite as reformed as he immediately thinks. But I remember watching this one and it just feels like, wow, he really turned into an ass really quickly. And I have to wonder if Loretta Swit was just like, I want to do other things. I don't want to just constantly be like Frank Burns, Penobscot, blah, blah, blah. I want to be my own thing. Do you get that feeling when you watch it?
Yes and no, actually. I can totally imagine Loretta being tired of always being all about the men and always having to have a love interest or going after someone. But when it comes to Scully as a character, I feel he just feels very complete in all of his three appearances to me. And it feels like they had a plan for him to begin with. He's just, because he has three appearances, and it's just, it's like the rule of three in storytelling, really, where you set up an idea in his first appearance when we see that, you know, he loves being loud and rowdy with the boys, but he wants Margaret to be cute and quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we see him again, we are reminded that, yeah, he is indeed a charming, fun guy, even though he's wounded. But he doesn't really like to take no for an answer. He's very insistent on getting some alone time with Margaret, and she protests, even though she does it in a very flattered and charmed way. We know that she likes his attentions, but it's still there. He's not a guy used to taking no for an answer. And then here in this episode, we get the reveal and the payoff. We see that what his true values are. He is used to being in charge and wants his woman to be sweet and obedient, and he's really like the Chekhov's gun of guest characters, where every element of the story needs to be necessary, and if a gun is introduced in the first act, that needs to be fired before the play ends. And every aspect of his character is necessary, and his ideals are introduced in the first act, and they go off here in the third. And yeah, it just feels like they had a plan for him to begin with. So I can see both sides of that, actually. Both Loretta being tired of constantly having to be all about men, and also that maybe there was a plan to begin with.
Yeah. When I was watching the Night at Rosie's episode for MASHcast, whatever that was, like 2 years ago at this point or something. And there was that line that he has where he says, Margaret, you talk too much. And that was a line that I just didn't notice the first 90 times I've seen that show. And then when I was reviewing it for the show, I was like, oh, well, that's a red flag right there, that this is someone he's just met. And he's already kind of saying, you know, oh, come on, you crazy lady, you're talking too much. I'm like, oh, boy. And so, yeah, if we're going to give the MASH writers credit, and why not, you could say, yeah, they were seeding that, right? They were already he seems charming. He seems roguish. We know that Margaret kind of likes a certain kind. I don't want to say bad boys, because Frank Burns was not a bad boy.
Anti-bad boy.
But like she, you know, she's attracted to that rough, I mean, you know, as Frank likes to say, we know you like rough and tumble guys or whatever, complimenting himself and stuff like that. But he's very charming, and Joshua Bryant was very charming in the role. But yeah, I could see that it's like, what, it's like someone that you meet casually, then you spend a lot of time with them, and then you're like, oh no.
Exactly. Yes. It's immediately the kind of guy the boys would like to hang out with and drink with, and Margaret would like to dance and flirt with. But the signs are there very early on.
Yeah. So the show opens under the directed by Harry Morgan credit, where they're doing a medical, you know, a doctor's conference kind of, they're all kind of goofing around about talking about how bored they are. Margaret is like, will you guys be quiet? This is, we're here to discuss serious medical things. And Potter's like, thank you, Margaret. Thank you, Major. Always a ray of sunshine. It's just simultaneously serious and sarcastic at the same
time. I love Potter and Margaret. I love the two of them together. And it's also such a great introduction of boredom, which is, of course, a theme throughout the episode. And also, childish things that we will see with starting out with a paper plane here, and Potter in the teacher role, and we will see, yeah, well, we'll see this theme with games of pretend and dressing up and grown men behaving like children and playing a role. And it's just such a nice contrast to some very adult themes that we will also see in the episode of respect and sexism and 50s values and not compromising who you are and toxic masculinity, really, with Scully, of course, and also BG and Charles bringing out the absolute worst in each other.
I love that when Hawkeye's making the paper airplane, and just the physical comedy of it is that he's got it folded and he rears it back ready to throw, and just then that's when Potter snatches it out of his hand and Hawkeye just kind of like good little bit of business
Perfect
there.
timing, Potter.
So they talk about the American College of Surgeons have they've got some news. Winchester says they are undoubtedly arresting you, Hawkeye, for loitering in front of an operating table. And then Potter says, "Don't touch it, Pierce," and he just lets that go. Okay, so they talk about this patient who he said had the air-conditioned colon, which is a ghastly way to describe it, but okay. So they talk about that that the people down at Walter Reed were saying he's doing fine, and everyone was so impressed that the American College of Surgeons are going to ask the doctors to write a paper on how they did it, which is very nice, right? That's an American College of Surgeons. It sounds pretty impressive. I don't know what that is, but it sounds.
It sounds very important. I'm happy for
Yeah,
them.
sounds really good. So, and of course, that means Winchester's, this is just nothing more than I deserve, which is like, okay, great. We're already off to a bad start. So, we then go to the swamp and they're sitting down to celebrate. Winchester's even breaking out what looks like, I think it's some cognac. Oh no, scotch, 12-year-old 12-year-old, scotch.
yes.
The 12-year-old scotch. Hawkeye jumps in and he says, "I'll get my 6-year-old glass and have a double." And Winchester's like, "Sorry, Pierce, this is for a private soiree for authors only." Now, I expect that out of Winchester, but then BJ's a little bit of a dick here to his friend, where he's like, "Hey, Hawk, this is kind of serious. Like, all right, come on."
Is. I like that aspect of BJ, that he is so focused on the task ahead and just sits there and stares down into his drink, and so he just does not want to play along with his friend this time. And Hawkeye, of course, can't deal with that. But it's a nice little change in their dynamics there when they aren't always besties, and BJ isn't always willing to play along. That's a nice little side of him.
Yeah. I mean, you got to think that you're doing all this amazing work at this unit. You're saving so many lives and you're not, and you feel probably unreward, not unrewarded, but that nobody's really paying attention to what you're doing. And so, you get these kudos and it's very exciting. I love it when Winchester says, "We will contact you if we are in the need of inanities." And the way that David Ogden Stiers hits the inanities, he's
He can deliver those lines as no one else. He's the master.
I've literally never heard the word inanities ever
No.
used in any other context ever in my life, except for this episode of Flash.
You need to start using
Yeah, I
it.
would love to work it in, but I just never, I know we can
And
never say it as well as him, but the way he puts like 17 extra syllables into
yeah,
inanities is really, really good.
absolutely. And yeah, it's so good. And I like the fact that Hawkeye isn't really wrong here, though. I mean, he's being kind of annoying and intrusive and want to be included, but they are, all of them have done pretty spectacular things, and they BG and Charles just happen to be noticed in this case. So yeah.
Yeah. So Hawkeye gets bored and he wanders out and he finds Mulcahy, Father Mulcahy, who is planning on visiting the orphanage. And he's so bored, he's just kind of bothering Mulcahy with, I would say, some inanities in this case. He's asking just incredibly nonsensical questions to the point that even Father Mulcahy is kind of like, I'm in a bit of a hurry. Can this wait? Is this
I
kind of.
know. I love the little eye roll he gives Hawkeye. He's like, "Oh, okay. I could play along for two sentences, but now it's okay. I really get it. I've got to get going."
Yeah.
He's cute.
There's a nice little piece of, sort of subtle filmmaking here is that if you watch the scene with them, you see the bat you see the space between the two rows of tents going to the background, the painted back, because this is, they're on the set here. They're not on, they're not out on the location. And so you see the backdrop, and there's nothing there other than some props and, you know, one or two people. And then while then the camera pans over a little, so we don't see that part of the camp anymore. We're looking at some tents behind Hawkeye and Mulcahy as they're talking. Then when Hawkeye and then when Mulcahy starts to drive away, they pan back over, and all of a sudden, coming down that quote unquote road is the Jeep with Scully in it. Now, we know from the physical reality of the set that's impossible because there's nothing back there. There's no. So they moved that Jeep into place. And then the minute Mulcahy's Jeep starts to move and the camera has to start panning, that's when Scully's Jeep starts moving forward as if it's been driving, as if that's a real road that you could come into the 407 from. It's a nice little subtle bit of business.
It really is. It's really clever. It looks good. I get really nervous when they drive those big Jeeps on that crowded little set, though. It looks so tiny. Mm-hmm. Like, oh my God, there should not be cars in there. But they make it work. It looks really good.
Yeah, yeah. It's a nice, every time Jeeps come in to the 477th, not from the main road, you're always like, wait, where did that Jeep come from? And of course, in the reality of the 477th, there's multiple roads to get in. But we know from the set, no, it's really can only come from one direction. But yeah, it's a nice little bit of business. By the way, in the background, we see Nurse Kelly is giving another nurse a haircut.
Yes, which is such a nice little detail. I love that. There's a lot of that going off. Someone cutting someone's hair or hosing someone down when it's hot. And it's always so cute to see that there's this whole life going on in camp outside of what our main characters are going through.
Do you have any girlfriends that you would trust to give you a haircut? I would imagine that's a very sacred thing for
I no, actually. I love my friends, but no.
Right. That's what I was, because in the early seasons of the show, they established that there was a barber. I think they showed him even one time or something, and then they've never showed him again. And so, obviously, in the later seasons, there's no barber at the force. They just have to give each other. We've seen Radar gave Potter a haircut, and then Klinger gives Potter a haircut. So they all just have to give each other haircuts. But I know that, of course, women's haircuts much more sophisticated than men's. Yes. Men could just kind of hack away, and it's close enough.
Right, but that looks like delicate work over there. I think it looks like Kelly's doing a good job.
yeah. I mean, it's good. My wife loves me, but if I said, "Can I cut your hair?" she would be like, "What the hell are you talking about?"
I love you, not that much.
No. I'm going to go spend $150 to go get this done professionally. Okay. So then we're back into the swamp, and we see that they're already arguing about the way they write, the way the paper should be written. And Winchester's like, an opening sentence should reach out by the reader and grab him by the throat, commanding him, read me, devour me, rush me in headlong flight to the conclusion. And it's a little overstated, but it's not wrong.
No, you need to grab your reader. Absolutely. I write fan fiction. I spend a lot of time thinking about my first line. So absolutely, I'm with Charles.
Yeah. My wife is a very good editor of my emails, because I tend to, when I write business emails, they tend to be larded with all sorts of like extra wording. And she's like, take that out. Just take that out. You know, I am always writing like, I'm just checking in to see. They don't need to they know why I'm writing. I don't need to mention, like, it's just like a bad habit. So she's always like, take that part out. I'm like, all right. And now I just sort of take it out because I know she's going to tell me to take it out before I take it out. So I am learning. They're kind of going back and forth about it. And then of course, BJ notices, well, why are you first? And of course he says, well, someone has to be first. It doesn't make any difference. Uh-huh. And BJ's like, then put mine first. And then of course, Winchester's like, are you mad?
Yeah. I love that. And I am so with Charles in this scene, because my surname also begin with a W, and we W's, we just need to go first every now and then. We are always at the bottom of every freaking list ever. We have to just sit there and wait to be called. So can you just give this to Winchester, Honeycutt, please? Just do it. We need it.
Interesting. See, I was actually on BJ's side, because Winchester's thing about that it's rank. I don't, the American College of Surgeons doesn't care about rank. They don't care about that's not, you know. So to me, it should always be alphabetical. Now, my name being K, I haven't suffered the way you have, having been stuck at the very end. So I hear you. I hear you. So, but I mean, I'm just like, if it was a military paper, then rank should go first. But the American College of Surgeons is like, well, we don't
care.
Yeah,
then it should be W first. Yeah. That's just natural.
So then, oh, go ahead.
Yes, I'm sorry. Can I just skip back to the previous scene? There's just one thing I want to mention when Scully shows up there. I think it's very typical for Hawkeye, first of all, to assume that Scully is there to see him. And he's like, yay, my other buddy is being boring, but now I can have a drink with my new cool friend. Hooray. And I also think it's so interesting when Scully calls Hawkeye cute and Hawkeye refers to himself as a skinny pale brunette. And Hawkeye does that a lot. He refers to him in more feminine terms and he makes pregnancy jokes about himself every now and then. And there's just, there are of course lots of different ways you can read Hawkeye, but to me it just tells me that he has this level of comfort in his own skin that I really enjoy. And I also want to bring it up because that comment about the pale skinny brunette and the sultry voluptuous blonde, that is one of my favorite things and one of my more superficial reasons as to why I really love Hawkeye and Margaret together, and just watching them together in scenes, this this contrast between them, the angles and the curves and the smooth and the scruffy and the dark and the light. It's just so pleasing to look at. And also since the two of them are basically the same person but also completely different, and just this difference in their appearance makes them, that highlights that in such a pleasing way. So I just wanted to point it out. It's one of my favorite things about them.
I've said on multiple shows, it's one of the things that really keyed me in on the show, was that the different form of masculinity presented by the MASH doctors was pretty unique on television, and that appealed to me because the whole kind of stupid machismo thing never did anything for me. And these guys can be very comfortable referring to themselves in a certain way, and as you say, you know, calling it a scale penny, you know, a pale skinny brunette, you know. And I like that he makes himself sound unappealing, you know, pale and skinny.
How can you not want this skinny paleness?
I have now been talking to the Mashpuller people for so long that I can now start. I'm now seeing lines I didn't notice before through the prism of the Mashpuller people, where I'm going, oh, that line. Oh, okay. Yeah, there we go.
Yeah, I'm fairly new to Tumblr and Mashpuller, and it's such a great place. But I am also starting to see things in such brand new ways, and it's so interesting. And I don't always agree. I have my ways of interpreting things, but it's so interesting. And I love that a show can be like this, that you can interpret these characters in so many ways, and you can just look at it through several different lenses, and it all makes perfect sense. And it feels like such a unique thing, and it's such a joy to have a favorite show that's like that, that works on so many levels and for so many people for so many reasons.
Mm-hmm. I also do like, I'm glad you went back to the scene, because there was something I did want to mention. I'm sure women do, but there is a code that dudes have where they can sort of express to each other, dude, I'd love to hang out, but there's the woman I want to go see, you know, and you're like, got it. All right. I understand.
Yeah, it's okay. Have a drink and then it's okay.
Yeah. All right. I understand. All right. That's fine.
Okay. I get it. But...
Priorities here. Priorities. Winchester and BJ, again, it's devolving. At one point, they're screaming at each other and they are almost nose to nose.
So close. Oh my goodness.
I have never stood that close to someone. I would be very uncomfortable.
Neither. I am such a fan of personal space, and I just need my personal bubble. I get so uncomfortable if people are too close to me, even if there's people I love and know. But it's just, hey, my bubble, please. I
Yeah,
need it.
yeah.
So that's, they are super, super close.
And that continues into the mess tent where we cut to Margaret, who is in the middle of those two insisting that they kind of be on each of their sides about which one of us clearly deserves the credit. And they're looming over her. They're not
Yes.
just sitting on the at the table. They're both BJ has his foot up on the bench and Winchester is leaning. So they're like looming over her and she's like, "Will you guys just leave me alone?" And then Potter is looking like,
Yeah, I know. And it's such a nice transition there, the way the two of them, BJ and Charles, rises up from the last scene, because they're such tall men, so it looks like two trees are just rising up. And then we see them just crowd in on poor Margaret, who just wants to have her coffee with Colonel Potter in peace. It's a
They were
very
probably
nice
having a very
transition.
nice conversation, right? The two of them
Right?
just.
Right. And speaking of closeness, because they are also sitting very close together, Potter and Margaret, there in the mess tent. And I noticed that in many episodes that characters tend to do that. They tend to sit very close when they're eating or having coffee in the mess tent. And I get that from like a technical point of view, that you want to get your actors into the same frame, but it also kind of makes sense for them to crave that closeness when you think about what they go through on a daily basis, and just losing people and having people grow cold under their hands. So it must be they must crave that closeness in some ways, and just have a warm, living, breathing body close to them. So it works both character-wise and just the technicality of getting every actor into the frame.
Yeah, they were probably having a very nice surrogate father, surrogate daughter
Yeah.
conversation, and then it gets interrupted by the, as Potter calls them, you two yahoos. Will you finish this before you hit puberty? So then Hawkeye brings in Scully, and Margaret, of course, she immediately brightens up and she's like, "Great to see you, especially in One Piece." And
Yes, and that's all.
Hawkeye is pretending that he doesn't know. And then Potter says, "Seems to be a lot of static electricity going on around here."
I love Colonel Potter. Oh, he's so chill.
It's great. She says, "Sergeant, how long has it been since you've had your shots record check? I've been too long, I'm sure. You better get, I'd like Hawkeye's, you better get to it then," because he's doing this kind of fake voice. Better get to it then. And he goes, "This would be a terrible time for this man to come down with a case of lockjaw." Okay, so
Oh my goodness.
when I was a kid and watched this episode, I thought that meant kissing.
Ah.
It's probably a dirtier joke than I gave it credit for as a child. I didn't understand any of that, but watching it as a so-called adult, I'm like, oh, yeah, okay.
Oh, so that's what they talk. Oh, that is one of the greatest joy you can have watching MASH, I think, when you have watched it for the first time as a kid, and just all the things just flew over your head. And especially when I watched it as a kid, I only read the subtitles. I couldn't follow along the English dialogue. So there were just so many jokes I missed out on, both translating wise and child versus adult wise. And it's been a great joy to rediscover MASH as an adult and actually start to listening to the real dialogue in English and skip the subtitles, because they do it so well. All of these this sneaky dirtiness they manage to sneak in so very well, and it's so funny. Ah, they do it so very well.
Yeah, I don't know how many. I really, it just, it was always like, oh, well, yeah, because he has lockjaw, that means he can't kiss Margaret. And then as I got older, I was like, oh, I see. Oh, got it. Okay, let's move forward here. So,
Dirty.
and then of course, BJ tries to get one more. Can I ask one more question about the operation? And Margaret is in her husky voiced, sultry thing, and she just goes, "Of course," and then
Of course.
walks away, not listening to him at all.
That is so perfectly delivered. I love that. Ah, I love Loretta Swit so much. But I also really like in this scene how both Charles and BJ are kind of smirking when Scully comes in, and then
Yep.
When Margaret brushes Speedy off, he looks a little bit sour there for a while. He doesn't like that, but overall, I get to say that I love that there are four men in this tent who are simply amused by the fact that the woman among them is off to do the devil's tango with this guy she isn't seriously involved with. It isn't Scully isn't her husband, he isn't her fiance. And just when you think about the values of the 50s, I just think that's pretty cool. And also, these guys have these moments when they are protective over Margaret in a way. All of them team up against that creep in Are You Now Margaret? And BJ is protective, and Tom goes after her in Major Ego, and Potter with that pilot in An Eye for a Tooth. But they are also so accepting of her being a sexual creature. It isn't strange or shocking to them that she has a affair at this point. And it's just, I really like that. I like that they can have this attitude of, hey, dude, we don't know, get your hands off our friend. But when they see that she actually wants someone and it's something she wants to go after, they are there to support her. And I just think it's such a sweet little detail about these guys.
Yeah, and Potter follows it up with dedicated nurse, that Major
Yeah,
Houlihan. And
he's so cool. I love Colonel Potter. Oh.
and Hawkeye says, "You got it, Colonel. She'll stay with that patient day and night." That's great. Yeah, they well, I mean, they're treating her like an adult that she is. It's like she's not married. You can do what she wants, okay? And she obviously likes this guy, so
An
okay,
adult-free
whatever.
woman.
Yeah.
Yes, it's such a great little detail.
Yeah. So Potter admonishes the two of them again. He's like, get back to work. And BJ's like, this is Dr. Diddlittle, and he's trying to rob me of my credit. And Winchester says, one cannot rob an empty safe, which is a
No.
marvelous turn of phrase, right?
Yes, it really is. Oh my goodness.
And then Hawkeye
And
is,
I,
of course, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
no, I'm sorry. I just got to mention this little the fact that Hawkeye is so excited about how
Yes.
they are not getting
Yes.
along. I just love it so much. He's like a little kid. And I love how when they walk out that he goes after them and he's so excited for them to fight some more. And when they are in Potter's office earlier, when they have received the news about this article that they're about to write, Margaret walks out after them, but she's so excited for them. She's like a happy little cheerleader, and Hawkeye is just happy that they're going to fight some more. And I find out such a fun little detail here. Because Hawkeye mentions Jeanette MacDonald and Nelson Eddy. And I found the most delightful little coincidence because they were, of course, a popular screen couple of the 30s and 40s, and they were opera singers. And they did a movie called Rosemary, where he plays a Mountie, which I assume is what Hawkeye is referring to here, his Mountie hat. And the most famous song in that movie is called Indian Love Call. And that is the song that Hawkeye sings in the shower in the beginning of Inga. And isn't that a fun
Really?
coincidence? Both of my episodes are held together by When I'm Calling
Wow. All right.
You.
Nice. Nice pull, Marie. I like that. That's great.
Happy when I found that out. I just had to go lie down on the couch for a while and ponder existence because it delighted me so.
I don't think I've ever seen a Jeanette MacDonald Nelson Eddy movie. And they made like
No.
half a dozen or more together, but I don't think I've ever
No.
seen one. So, okay. I
Me
did.
neither.
I
I've
like
just
the way
seen
he
that.
says it though. Like stepping on Nelson
Yeah.
Eddy's Mountie
Step
hat.
on.
He's just
He's so into it. And there's a little clip on YouTube on this song, Indian Love Call, that you can check out. They stare into each other's eyes and sing, and they look so serious, and they're so close together, them two. So
All
it's
right, very nice. Again, nice pull. Well
cute.
done. Well
Thank
done. Well
you.
done. Excuse me, Colonel Potter kind of gets on them again, and he underlines the point saying, hey, this is going to be good for the unit that people know we're not just a band spit and band-aid operation. So get this done. And which I like that he's ramping up the pressure, not the pressure, but he kind of saying, look, guys, this is not just about you. This is about all of us. and you're down, you know, this would help us as a unit and all the MASH units. So knock it off. You know, he's finally kind of exactly. getting like, all right, enough already. You know, stop being a bunch of ninnies.
He's got the bigger perspective there.
Yeah. He has just enough to do that it's not noticeable. It doesn't feel like he's missing from the episode, but you know why he's not in it as much, because he's busy behind the camera.
Yes.
You know, other than exactly. Alan Alda, it's probably kind of hard to direct yourself. So he kind of, you know, he's Potter's just on the periphery on this episode.
Yes, he is. And he was award nominated for this.
Yes,
he got Emmy Award. Yeah,
he got nominated for an Emmy. That's right.
And he does. It's very noticeable. He does bring out the best in each and every actor, I think, and they all seem very comfortable. And there's a nice flow to the episode with peaks and valleys in the scenes. So yeah, I get why.
Yeah. Also, the way the Emmys work, this is how the Emmys work now. I assumed they work the same in the 70s, that it's been always this way, but I could be wrong. But you have to submit episodes for consideration. The okay. Emmys don't just like look at they don't watch a whole season of television and pick something. You have to submit an episode, and you have to submit in specific categories. So that means somebody on the MASH side of the, you know, somebody on the production side of MASH submitted this episode as a potential directorial Emmy credit. So that's interesting to me. That was that just they thought this was a really, you know, did the MASH producers just pick a couple and, you know, okay, for your consideration, and this is the one the Emmy voters picked? Or was it this one to get Harry, you know, to kind of be like, hey, let's, you know, was Harry Morgan being the director a factor in submitting it to the Emmys over some other factor? We'll never
exactly.
know.
Yeah, it feels, yeah. I can imagine it being that way. Directorial awards is just, it's kind of abstract to me. When you see like an award-winning performance from an actor, it's so much easier to pinpoint what it is that actor is doing. That's so great. You can feel the emotion, and you get a sense of what the jury is seeing. And when something is really well written, it's also easier to just catch on to what it is that is so well written. But with directors, it's more abstract, really.
Yeah. The Scully and Margaret start having a drink, and he talks about he wants to go get freshened up, and he says, why do that? How do they say in the movies? Why don't you go slip into something more comfortable? That's you're already like.
Yeah.
Okay. Like, and then he says, you must have a nice sexy dress in there somewhere. And it's like, what?
On earth, what he is expecting her to have in her wardrobe. Like, what?
They're 5 miles from the front. What?
Like, yes, I mean, a bathrobe, but maybe she has that. But like a sexy dress, that's a very specific thing to expect.
Just... having sex with her is not enough. You're
no,
gonna go.
She has to get dolled up for him first.
That's I put that in my notes. The dolled up. I'm like, no.
And it's all about him. You know, a guy likes to see his gal all dolled up for him. It's all for his viewing pleasure and for his gaze. And I was thinking about, is there something he could have said instead in this moment that wouldn't have been, you know, as bad, really? And I couldn't really think of something good. Just maybe, you know, I'd like to get to know who you are when you're not wearing your uniform or something. Just see another side of her personality. But of course, we will find out that he isn't super interested in seeing sides of her personality. So, yeah.
Yeah. It's unfortunate. He takes his jacket off, and she says, Jack, you are the most adorable man. Just look at you. And he's like, what? And she says, you're in such a rush to see me, you put on somebody else's shirt. And she's referring to the fact that he's got a private stripe on his shirt. Now, it's funny how fast she notices that. Like, he's facing the side of him is facing the camera. So it's framed so we can notice it. But it is kind of funny that, like, she's not looking in his eyes. She's not looking, like, she immediately picks up on the fact that he's got a private stripe, which is a thing we know about Margaret. Rank is very important to Margaret. She has the classic line, I could never love someone who didn't outrank me, you know? So this is a big deal to her, but it's just sort of funny that she's almost like a Sherlock Holmes noticing some detail that nobody else would pay attention to in that moment.
Yes, her eyes are immediately drawn to the symbol of power. That's really interesting, and says something about where she is at this point. She has come very far, but she is still really drawn to rank. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I like the little detail that you can see on Scully's shirt, that there's a darker patch where his other stripe used to be. So it's just a little nice little attention to detail there.
Like somebody like literally ripped it off his shirt or something. And so he mentions that, he punched a second lieutenant and he got knocked down. And he says, you know, I go up and down so far, they call me Xylophone. And she's like, that's terrible. And she says, but Jack, in the army, rank means everything. And he says, my CO calls me Yo-Yo. And she's like, that's terrible. And he says, it doesn't change a thing when we're moving up a ridge with a commie 30 trying to cut us in half. All of a sudden, he's talking like Sergeant Rock. It's me the guys follow, and that includes the lieutenant. And Margaret is like, well, that's just what I mean. You're too good for this. Now, we've been dumping on Scully in this episode, rightly so.
Yeah.
But this is where I'm like, Margaret, you're by making it sound as though being a sergeant or a corporal is somehow like a low. I mean, yeah, I know in military rank, it literally means lower. I get it. It's what the ranks are. But she's very dismissive. She's very, very dismissive of non-officers. And that's like a little like, Margaret, okay, like settle down a little bit on that. On that one, I think.
Super great. And that really is the thing with her. She, you know, she wants, she has a very clear way of how she sees the world, and she wants everything to fit into that little box. And rank means everything, because that's what her father told her once upon a time. And I think both Scully and Margaret are a lot alike in a lot of ways. And I think this is sort of one of those moments where we see that, she isn't, you know, really open to accepting this new version of Scully that comes into camp. And she's very set in her ways, and Scully is very set in his ways. And they're both just very used to getting what they want, and they go about it differently. But it's not one of Margaret's more charming sides, that's for sure.
And we're going to see what the problem is, because she says, you know, you're officer material. And he says, thanks, but no thanks. I've been offered battlefield commissions. I turned them down. And I love, she's so annoyed. She's like, you what? She's so pissed. She's like that to Margaret. Yeah. That is like, he just said, blip, 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 blip. Like, it just makes no sense to Margaret at all that he would do something like that.
How can anyone not want that? And you know, telling him that he's officer material, that is a huge compliment for her. And
And then, you know, so now it's kind of flipping on. And I'm like, okay, Scully, that's his decision. He doesn't want to be an officer. He wants, you know.
And I think Scully's, where Scully's coming from here is so interesting too, because he says again that it's him that the men follow, no matter what his rank is, and that is what's important to him.
Yep.
And I think if the men didn't listen to him as just a lowly private, maybe he would care about his rank, you know. But but he can afford not to, because he is a cool dude. The men wants to be like him, and the women wants to be with him, and he has this natural charisma and is used to getting what he wants and used to that people listen to him. And I think that it made me think about Scully and Hawkeye, how I think they are actually a bit alike here, because Hawkeye, of course, he doesn't want to be there, he hates the army and he hates the war, but he still enjoys being the big guy in camp in some ways. He loves to be the one people admire and listen to, and the one who can get away with things just because of who he is as a person, with his natural charisma and charm. And, you know, earlier, before, when Radar was still around, Hawkeye tells Radar that he doesn't want him to idolize him, because he has enough on his shoulder. But he's also, He's also very quick to tell Radar that it's okay to worship the ground I walk on. And it's like, that. Those are pretty big words, pretty quick there, Hawkeye. But yeah, I think both Scallion and Hawkeye are used to getting respect, or they get respect without even trying. From Margaret's perspective, while she has to fight so hard and not get nearly as much, and that truly bothers her, and she has to try so hard, but her ambitions still get made fun of. And you know, in an early episode, Hawkeye even implies that she has slept her way to her position. And I don't know, what do you think about that? Do you think she has?
They certainly made that. They certainly suggested that in the early episodes, in the very early episodes, where she was clearly having sex with every general that kind of came by the 477th. But I think they retroactively kind of got rid of that, and they were like, I think the suggestion was more not that Margaret was sleeping her way to the top, as it were, that it was Margaret is simply sexually attracted to power. She just is. And a man who is a general, even though some of the men that she clearly had relations with in the early seasons were not the most appealing men in the world, let's just put it that way, that her power is a massive aphrodisiac to Margaret. And that's separate from her skills as a nurse. You know,
exactly.
That's clearly separate from what that is. So, and then of course, in the, you know, just last season, that other guy offers her a promotion the general offers her a promotion if she'll be basically his concubine, and she's like, get the hell out of here. I don't do that, you know? So yeah, it's in the early seasons when the show was not quite as evolved as it became, I think that was the intimation, but I think they sort of sifted that out.
Absolutely. And I think that for me, Margaret has obviously made many bad decisions regarding her love life. She hasn't really been super bothered if a guy is married or not. And that is, of course, the man's responsibility too. But, you know, she is attracted to uniforms and having control over a powerful man. And then there is this whole dimension with feeling like a failed daughter. So I think, for me, she has many reasons to be with a man, but I don't think she had ever slept her way to a promotion, because she was too proud, and too proud of her abilities. And I think that's part of why she gets so mad at Scully in this scene, because people keep assuming that she has done that, that she has slept her way to what she has, and she hasn't earned what she's got. And where she actually has really put her head down and worked hard and said no to some offers, as we have seen. I think that Scully's words are extra painful for her in this moment, because he doesn't respect what she truly has accomplished.
Yeah. And you can see that from Margaret's point of view, because we've seen it on the show itself, and I'm sure it's within the greater context of the character off, you know, on episodes that we never saw, was that there were lots of men in the military who only listened to Margaret because she is a major, because they literally have to, even though Margaret should be listened to because she knows what she's doing and she's good at her job. So from her point of view, her rank is incredibly important because it forces other people to listen to her when she knows in other contexts they never would. So she's sort of like, okay, I have to earn. It's sort of like the whole, I've got to work twice as hard to get half as far kind of thing. But it's like, you could see that Margaret would value her majordom, because it's like, well, without this, a lot of these knuckleheads wouldn't listen to me, and maybe people would die. Maybe soldiers would die. Maybe other things would not get done the way they get done. So therefore, this rank is very important to me. Yes, I've earned it, but I also know that it is a shortcut to some of the dummies that I got to deal with. And so you can understand that from her point of view, totally, you know,
for sure. And she can never allow herself to be as laid back as Hawkeye or Scully. She has to constantly cling to her leaves on her collar to get the amount of respect that she should have gotten anyway.
And she literally does that in this episode, where he talks about, because then Scully's about to undo all the progress he might have made. here when he says, well, she says, I'm a major. He says, you're a nurse. That's an honorary thing. So you can boss around a bunch of nurses, but not men, not real soldiers.
Bad. The fact that she didn't punch him there, I think, shows that she has done some growth. You know, she's more mature now.
That's just, and then she literally grabs her oak leaves and says, "You, nobody gave them to me. I earned them." And then she's like, "You notice they don't come in two colors. You know, blue for, blue for boys and pink for girls or whatever."
Yes, I love that.
It's just, it's so you boss around a bunch of women.
My goodness, that is a Scully. That's so bad. Being a nurse is so important. And Margaret is so proud of herself and so proud of her nurses, even though she can't really say that to them, unfortunately. But I mean, all Margaret Houlihan could ever be was an army nurse. But under different circumstances, if she hadn't had the upbringing that she had with her father and the army, I think she still would have become a nurse, to be honest, because it's in every fiber of her. And maybe she would have aimed for a doctor, to be a doctor if given the right opportunity. But she is 100% a nurse, and she's so proud of it and does so many good things. And don't insult that and make it sound small. Scully, my guy, please.
Yeah. Oh, boy. So he storms out, and that's our act break.
Yes, and, so that's, then, and when he leaves her there, which he goes, oh, the you have the brass for it, and there's only khaki in your closet because you're such a man, and he calls her sir. Oh, my God. And that, again, I think that he and Hawkeye has so much in common because, you know, Hawkeye and Trapper does that several times in the early seasons. And Radar just can't remember if he should call her ma'am or
sir.
They keep making fun of her femininity because she isn't always sweet and pleasant, and it's, you know, the way it's been for women with ambition and a clear goal for their career, how they have been talked to through generations. And I started to think about how Margaret talks about herself and when it comes to gender, because, you know, she seems very happy to be in a female body, and she likes her makeup, and she likes her fingernails very, very inappropriately long. but she also refers to herself as a married man in a conversation with Frank one time, and an engaged person instead of a woman. And this is man talk. She snaps at Radar in another episode. And
that's right. But Al, this is man talk. I'm sorry, sir. He runs away.
Oh, that's cute. But and we also see that she has this surprisingly open mind, really, when Radar tells her about that guy back home who used to wear women's clothing.
Yes.
And she just goes, to each his own.
Yep. It's
surprising.
I love that line, man. That really...
Wow. And it's just such a little throwaway line that just says so much about her all of a sudden. It's so great. And then we have Klinger, of course, who is a disgrace to the army in her mind, but he is a disgrace to the army, whether or not he's in a dress or if he's sitting on a pole or eating a Jeep or has an imaginary camel, you know, it's just constant with him. And so I just think that it's interesting that she is comfortable referring to herself not just in those feminine terms, but of course here when Scully or Hawkeye or Trapper does it, it's just to bring her down. And to Scully, a woman with ideals and ambitions that are more male coded, that's just not something he can deal with. And and also there's Margaret's father again. Maybe she grew up feeling like she should have been a boy, because that's what her father would have wanted, and she can never be the soldier he truly wanted her to be. And she is still that little 5-year-old who had a crying fit because she couldn't get a crew cut. And when someone insults her ambitions and ideals by comparing her to a man, it's just extra painful because of that whole background with her father and not being able to give him what he truly wanted. So I think it has layers for her, that those kinds of insults.
Yeah, Yeah. And, you know, it's anyone who's ever been in a relationship knows how occasionally something can go from 60 to zero very quickly, you know, where you're all of a sudden you're having a good moment and then you get it. Something triggers an argument and all of a sudden 45 seconds later, you're like, how did we get here?
Kind of thing. What happened?
What happened? You know, Scully arrived with a bottle of wine thinking he was about to have a fun-filled 12 hours of sexual adventuredom, and now he's storming out. It's like, wow, this did not go like I planned. Okay.
No, this was not the afternoon he had in mind, for sure.
Yeah. So we come back to Winchester and BJ working on the paper. Winchester is dictating to BJ, and he is making his part of the operation sound like a combination of Dr. Kildare and the charge of the Light Brigade and a little bit of 300 thrown in there. Like, he is just going on. And then BJ's had enough, you know, and then he says, this whole thing with exteriorizing the colon was my idea, which is a festival of errors, Honeycutt. And they're just going. And it's fun to see this side of BJ because he is being kind of petty. I mean, Winchester's pushing him, but it's funny to see BJ be kind of a jerk a little bit. It's nice to be able to get all these balance, you know, the characters are rounded the way they should be.
Yeah, exactly. I like this in BJ. I like that we get to see his sour side a lot, actually. It grows with him over the seasons, and I always find it interesting that he has that in him. And also about this whole thing about exteriorize the colon, isn't that what Frank failed to do in
his
engagement that almost killed that
yes
season? Yeah. Yes. It's interesting that they have that in two episodes where two of Margaret's relationships fall apart or end.
I'm picturing your house with like this bulletin board with all these connective tissue with like push pins and strings going to Jeanette McDonald question mark. You know?
That is almost true, actually. I have so many notes and I have them like color coordinated, so it's super ambitious.
So, but yeah, that's the when Frank is called on that and he's like, well, that's war on me, and they're like, wow, you're really being a good sport about it. The guy almost died for Pete's sake.
Everyone gets mad at Margaret because she breaks up with Frank in a poor way, which she does. It's a horrible way of breaking up with someone. But shouldn't people be mad at Frank too for almost killing someone? Like, hello, what's going on here?
He's a terrible doctor. Terrible, terrible doctor. So we then join Hawkeye, who is continually bored. He's in the O Club. He is trying to get Igor, of all people, to play Scrabble with him. And Igor doesn't want to play anymore because he says Hawkeye wouldn't let him use 2 G's in pig. So
and actually here, if Igor had been allowed to spell a pig with 2 G's, he would have spelled the Swedish word pig, which means alert and lively. So, I mean, maybe Igor is just some kind of genius. We don't know.
Maybe he's Swedish. We don't
know. Maybe he has a Swedish girlfriend. He has a lot of girlfriends. You never know. Maybe it's Inga.
There you go. So, so that's how low Hawkeye is sunk is that he can't even get Igor to play with him, which is you've fallen pretty far there on the cultural ladder here at the 477th. Social ladder, I should say, at the 477th. So then Margaret comes in and she's furious and she's mad and she calls Scully a jerk and an ignoramus. And Hawkeye's like, ignoramus, that's a 15-point insult. And all he wants to do is get her to play the Scrabble, and she's not paying attention. And then she says he should be a private, and he's like, Scully's a private, and she, you know, he doesn't know what she's talking about. She's having an argument with Scully to Hawkeye, and he's kind of like, wait, what are we talking about this? And then he finally says, she's like, you know, she doesn't know a woman can be a woman and a major at the same time, and he's like, Margaret, that's just Scully. And then she says, man, you know, I knew what Connie was when you met him, right? A typical man.
Yeah.
He says, don't lump us all together. Scully and I were completely different guys. You and I didn't get along so well at the beginning, which we all saw that.
Yeah.
Says, that's exactly my point. You different men are all alike.
I love that. And it's just, I love this scene so much. And she has, she has just played a lot of games with a lot of men, and it truly bothers her. And that's when Hawkeye says that it's not easy to become what someone wants you to be, because she has, and she has done it so many times. And it's, you know, what her father wants her to be, and what the army wants her to be, and what her lovers want her to be, and her husband. It's just what Margaret truly wants to be. I don't think she has ever stopped long enough to try and figure that out. And I think it would scare her, to be honest, if she actually sat down and tried to think about it, because what if she would realize that she wants to be something other than what her father wants her to be? And this actually, it brings me all the way back to Hot Lips and Empty Arms, and the scene with Frank and the Doris Day scrapbook and Bimbo the dog, where Frank says, "This is so unlike you." And she says, "No, it's not. If I'd been more like me, maybe you would have liked me more." And that is just such a sad line in such a lighthearted setting. And it just tells us that, you know, even all the way back then, she was aware that she was playing a role with Frank. She was presenting a version of herself that was pleasing to him, and that she was pushing aspects of herself down, really.
She's, I mean, it's, you know, she's, this is the 50s, you know, it's
Yeah.
tough enough to find men that are okay with strong women in 2025, let alone
Exactly.
1950. And so it's a hard fit for her. You know, it really is.
Exactly.
Now she mentions Frank Burns and Donald, which is like, you know,
Yeah.
it's like saying Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice is just
Yeah.
saying Frank Burns a couple of times. And then she's like, and now this ninny. And he's like, oh,
Yeah.
well, excuse us all for not being perfect. And she's like,
Yeah.
perfect? None of you
Perfect.
even tried. And
Yeah. Yes, and again, she's just so tired of being the only one to put on all of these roles and try to adapt to whatever man she's with.
Hawkeye himself drops a reference that if you are a devotee of the show, which of course we all are, that's why we're here, is
Yes.
where he says it's tough to be, as you just mentioned, he says it's tough to be something that you're not. And he says, I couldn't do it in med school for the woman I loved,
Yeah.
and I won't do it for an army I hate. Now, of course, we all know he's talking about Carly Breslin, who we've met on the show. And like, you know, as a obsessive MASH fan, dropping a Carly Breslin reference is like, that's just like waving a treat in front of a dog. You know, I'm like, oh, you know, because I
Yes,
love that episode so much. And I'm like, the
Marnie.
fact that they just drop it in so casually, and if you were not a devotee of MASH and just watched it just for
Yeah.
entertainment, you might have been like, I don't know what, all right, I don't know what that is, but I love that he invokes this legendary name of this person who we saw and led to like one of like my all-time favorite episodes. I love that they did that. MASH was so sloppy with its continuity, but I
Yeah, it
liked it
was
when they
in
made
many
the
ways.
effort to do that. So
For
I
sure.
love
And
that.
even if you aren't a hardcore MASH fan, and he just drops that line about the woman he loved, and it's a nice little insight to Hawkeye there, if you've just seen him as this more of a ladies' man who likes to party and have relationships, but it doesn't really matter to him. So here we hear at least that, oh, he used to love someone. He can be serious too. That's a nice little piece of information about him, even if you don't get the whole Carly reference.
Yeah, I love it. Love it. And so
Yeah.
he finally says, well, why don't you just forget about Scully? And then Margaret says, because I
Yes.
like him, you
I
dummy.
like him, you. And he grabs his ear and is like, oh, that was loud.
I love that
I
she's
love
so
him.
frustrated with him. And it's like,
Yes.
because I like him, that's why I'm putting up
You
with all this
dummy.
nonsense.
And just the fact that they are having this conversation, it's that they have both come so far at this point. And just admitting, for Margaret to admit that something is wrong, and he's there to try and cheer her up, and they have this balance and this friendship between them, and at this point, and it's just so good. And I also, can I just tell you a very nerdy and specific reason as to why I wanted this
Of
episode in
course,
particular,
of course.
because it has to do with this scene. And okay, it's like this. I have some many clear memories from watching MASH for the first time as a kid. I remember all of the dead people walking down the road in Follies for the Living, and that little baby being left in the dark, and Yes, Sir, That's Our Baby. And I remember Hawkeye and Margaret kissing in Comrades in Arms, and that thrilled me because a young little me was a huge Hawk March shipper, so that made me very happy. But I also clearly remember this scene for some reason, where Margaret Houlihan is drinking beer in the O Club, and she's drinking from the bottle. That was just the coolest thing I had ever seen when I was little. And Margaret was already the coolest character I knew, and this was just the cherry on top of the coolness cake. And I, of course, wanted to be just like her and drink from bottles too. But sadly for me, I did not have a lot of opportunities to do this. This was a long time ago. I may sound like a young ingenue, but I am in fact not. I was born in the late 70s. And back then, soda was not a big thing. I could have one soda a week, and I could drink it on Saturdays with dinner, and I had to drink it from a glass because we weren't barbarians, my mother informed me. But I did have one opportunity though, and this was in the summertime when my dad was out mowing the lawn. And again, this was a long time ago. We had this big, heavy lawnmower. It had no motor, and it was absolutely not one of those little robots that you see today. It was just this heavy chunk of orange metal that you had to push around with nothing but the strength of your muscles. So it was sweaty work, and when he was done, he would be thirsty. So he would go into the basement, and he would get himself a bottle of tonic water, and he would sit out on the back porch and drink it from the bottle. And I would, of course, seize the opportunity. I would come running up to him going, "Dad, can I have a sip?" And I always could. And it was gross and it was bitter, but, you know, I took what I could get and I powered through. And in those moments, I was as cool as my favorite, Margaret Houlihan. I was on top of the world. We were just two wild women drinking from the bottle. No one could tell us what to do. We marched to the beat of our own drum. And then, you know, since I was a child, when the tonic water was done, I went back into my room and read horse magazines and played with my dolls. But still, you know, the connection between Margaret and me was there. And it's such a treasured memory, and it's a sweet treasured memory of my father too. He passed away many years ago, and he was the one who introduced me to MASH. And just him and me out on the back porch on a warm summer day, sharing a bottle of rose tonic. Those are just very treasured memories for me. And every time I watch Stars and Stripes, I am reminded of that, and also of how cool I was back then in those moments, drinking from the bottle. And that is a very nerdy and specific and nostalgic reason as to why I wanted this episode. I just wanted to mention it.
That's a beautiful story. Thank you for sharing that. That's a beautiful that
you.
That your comments on the website have always been such a pleasure to read, and they're very lengthy. And I mean that in the you know,
are
totally complimentary, but they're, you know, and so I feel like that's something that you might have, if you had not been on this episode,
yes,
you might have written that. And I'm glad I got to hear it. I'm glad I'm getting to sit here hearing it live and getting to hear it directly. You know, that's a beautiful
thank
story.
Thank you so much. I'm glad I got to tell it. Thank you so much.
Yeah. It reminds me of that, you know, that idea that, you know, when someone makes art, no matter what the art is, once you've put it out there, you kind of can't control what it becomes. And it, you know, you might even say, well, I didn't intend on making that, but someone took it that way, and now it is that thing, you know? And so, you know, the idea that, like, they would, I'm sure that having Margaret drink from a beer bottle, which they did on MASH, because nobody's bothering with glass, like, that's a detail that no one would have ever given two thoughts to.
No.
On the show, because it's just like, well, she's going to have a drink and they don't drink from glasses, so give her a bottle. And that's
exactly,
it.
Exactly.
And yet it is radiating inside your skull to a young girl on the other side of the world. And it's, you know what I mean? Like, it's an amazing thing that this thing done here in 1979 is shooting its way across the planet and it's become this beloved memory in your life. Like, that's just a fantastic thing, you know?
It is. And it's for sure one of the reasons that I love MASH so much, and that it's such a tremendous show to have in your life. Because, I mean, whether you discovered it as an adult or a child, you will always have this very specific things that you sort of latch onto, and they will come and mean more to you than what they were on the page, you know, what the creators could ever have imagined back then. Yeah. So yeah, it's a terrific thing to have in your life.
It's amazing the stuff you see as a child that, again, like the people that made it would have no idea that this little decision they made on the list of 10 million decisions they have to make to create a TV show or a movie or a song, and yet it, what it does to someone out there who's taking it in at the right age, right? At the right exact moment. And it just stays with them. I can think of a couple examples like that of just something where, you know, if I mention it, you'd be like, really, that? And you're like, yeah, I don't know why. Yes. I don't know why that landed on me, but it did, you know, so.
It did, because you watched it at a specific time in your life where it was just the perfect thing at the perfect moment. And it moves into your soul, really.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Thank you for telling that, Marie. That's a wonderful, wonderful story. So, and Margaret was cool. Margaret is the coolest, you know. Margaret taking a shit for people, you know. It's great.
I know, and also it's all about Loretta Swit's portrayal of her, of course. And I just can't say enough nice things about her, and I still can't believe that she's no longer with us. She brought so much to Margaret, and just the way that she fought for her and really never settled. She wanted more from Margaret, and showed that she was this complex character with layers and nuances and a will and needs and drives. And it was just a pleasure to be on that ride with her and see. And watch Margaret grow through her, and she brought this incredible vulnerability to Margaret in everything she does, even at Margaret's lowest and at her absolute worst points. If you look into her eyes, you can see that Loretta Swit just knows that there's so much more going on than Margaret being a bitch in that moment. She comes from somewhere, and she's constantly so aware of Margaret's backstory and where she's going and what she has to do to get the things she wants. And it's so beautiful. And may she rest in peace. It was a very sad day when I found out that she had passed away.
I mean, I got to meet her a couple of times, and that was wonderful. But the one moment I think about the most in the couple of times I got to meet her was when I handed her my Hot Lips action figure to sign.
Aww.
And those things were so ungainly and goofy looking, and she signed it and then held it up to her face, and she goes, "Does this look like me?" And it just disarmed me. You know, I was so nervous to meet her because it was Loretta Swit, and yet she made me laugh, and I realized, she is taking this in the spirit it's intended, because I could see that maybe someone else who's maybe not as comfortable with their outside persona being handed a hunk of plastic that looks nothing like them might have been like, why are you handing me this? But she, you know, does this look like me? No, it doesn't. Aww. It doesn't, Loretta. It doesn't. So
that's so nice. Oh, I love her so much. And you also have that wonderful going out to get her lunch.
Yeah, going out to get her lunch. Yeah,
oh,
crazy.
My goodness.
Crazy, crazy,
if
crazy.
If that had been my story, it would be all I ever talked about. My goodness. My friends would be so annoyed with me.
there's that thing about, like, if you have a fire in your house, like, what are the three things outside of your family, your pets or whatever? What are the first What three things are you grabbing before the fire? And one of them would be my signed Margaret, Loretta Swit action figure, because it's irreplaceable. You know, it's literally yes. irreplaceable. I'm looking at it right now as I'm talking to you. It's in this little glass case. And I'm like, goodness. Yeah, I would be with like, I grab that and throw it out the window to make sure it survived. So.
Oh, that's so great. I love that. Oh.
So anyway, after the scene with Hawkeye and Loretta Swit, Margaret, we finally see Klinger. Klinger gets his first appearance in this episode, and he is making a dress for Margaret. I like the idea that by seeing all these other dresses hanging in the background, obviously she's tried other ones on, that he has his whole – the Klinger collection is in storage somewhere in the supply room, which I love that the – that again, if we're going to like extrapolate out and like that Colonel Potter's okay with that, right? That he's letting part of the unit's supply tent be used to get to house Klinger's collection.
That's so nice. And I love that it's so important to Klinger. And I really love that they gave him a genuine interest in clothes and fashion and that he can sew, obviously, because, you know, they could so very easily just have made him wear whatever ugly house frock they could find through the seasons. But no, he is genuinely into fashion. And I love that little detail that they gave him. It just tells us so much about Klinger as a character.
He calls himself Mr. Max. Yes! You know, he's giving himself this persona and like she's being snippy and he's like a little temperamental, aren't we today? So he's doing the whole bit. You know, he's doing this whole persona. And then she cradles his face and she's like, Klinger, I need a dress that shows I'm soft, alluring, and demure. And if you don't help me, I'm going to break your cheeks.
I love that so much. I love when Loretta plays with her voice like that. It's always so much fun. And that brings me all the way back to another episode. I keep following my little threads over here. And it's in Last Laugh when she is so high energy and so revved up throughout the entire episode. She just has to go see Donald because he is such a manly man and he has needs. And okay, Margaret. Of course, it's only Donald who has needs, if you say so, whatever. But then the difference when she comes back and she is so relaxed, excuse me, Donald is so relaxed. It's just so much fun the way she does it when she is all, her voice is all smooth. And it's so much fun. And I mean, Loretta said that so very well. She can be so loud and so just demand so much attention and that was one of the things that drew me to Margaret as a character when I was a kid, that she just tapped into all of this anger and she got so mad and she got too mad and she was just demanding space in a way that I never really felt that I could. I didn't feel like I was entitled to her emotions. They could never be big like that. But I kind of found an outlet through Margaret Houlihan, really. And I just love how she can switch back and forth like that, forth and back and forth, just being very forceful and then very seductive and very soft. And it's always so much fun. And I also, one little Margaret detail in the beginning of this scene when we see her shoes.
She's got the boots on, yeah.
Yeah, her boots are very unpolished and worn down. And that made me think that they have just gone downhill since Frank left because he isn't there to spit on the tips anymore and polish them for her.
So, by the way, break your cheeks as well is just a ghastly thing. Like, that's really painful. That sounds I'm going to break your arm. Well, that sounds pretty bad, but breaking your cheeks, I don't even know how that's even, how do you even do that? I don't even understand.
How would you go about that? I'm kind of interested. That sounds
utterly ghastly to have your cheeks broken. That just sounds like the most painful wound possible. So, and she says it with her teeth kind of like, I'm going to break your cheeks. Gritted teeth. So then we're joining our doctors back in the swamp and they are now writing their own papers. And Hawkeye, as you pointed out, is just gloating that they're being such ninnies. And then he says, you might stand a chance, Charles. BJ says, you might stand a chance, Charles, if Colonel Potter accepts bribes. And he calls him a boob. Potter walks in. Hawkeye says, the Brothers Grimm are writing their own separate papers. And then he underscores it. And you get to grade them, Teach.
Yay.
Which
He's
is
like a
ridiculous.
little kid.
It's like, that's what, Potter's got better things to do than read two separate papers and what, graph them together? Like, get the hell out of here.
Come on.
So Potter has had enough. He grabs a chair and he sits down and he starts going through the list of all the people that helped this guy. He says the combat medics, the evac people, did one hell of a job getting us Hauser here alive. And he's like, wouldn't you not agree, Winchester? And Margaret's at a camp record getting him prepped, right, Honeycutt? And and Hawkeye is being such a little, he's like,
yes! He's so happy that they're being told off by the teacher. And I really like how Charles goes, yes, when Potter points this out. And BJ goes, yeah, I guess so. He just sounds a little bit more surly here. And again, I find it so interesting. And I find BJ's whole journey through the seasons so very interesting. And I read somewhere on Tumblr, I can't take credit for this, but someone posted about how BJ and Hawkeye sort of evolve in opposite directions. Hawkeye starts out at this cynical and jaded and mean man, but he grows warmer and softer.
He mellows. He definitely mellows.
He does.
Yep.
His bad sides, you know, they're still there, his bad sides, but they sort of get sandpapered down a little. While BJ starts out more open and warm, and he's trying to stay positive, but he turns more cynical and mean really as time goes by. And I really love that thought, that there's this constant balance between them, that where one grows to be a little warmer, the other one grows a little bit colder, and you know, they give things to each other and they have other things taken away, and what BJ loses, Hawkeye gains. And it's just this, I was really drawn to that thought.
That's a really interesting observation. I hadn't really thought of it exactly in quite those clear terms, but that's absolutely true. And whenever we get to the season 11 episode, I don't know what guest is going to be on that one, but the one, the bombshells one where BJ has to cut the soldier loose to save his own life. That is about as dark. I'm like, that is dark, darkity, dark, 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 you know,
it
for a character.
Really is.
And his whole speech that he has, but that's a podcast for another day.
Yes.
So Potter is going on and on about, he says, you know, what about the people down at what about the people down in Posada that took care of him? What about the hospital? What about Walter Reed? What about the EVAC hospital in Seoul? The medics in San Francisco? And then he says, I'm running out of how abouts. Walter Reed. And then Hawkeye says, what about Hauser himself? And Potter's like, how about him? Damn brave kid.
Yeah.
And that shames BJ into it. And then they finally realize, for someone who was worried about class and being erudite and all this thing, taking credit that is not yours is, you know, very D-class A. And he sort of talks, he says, I assume more credit than I deserve it. And so they decide, okay, we're going to submit it by the entire 4077. So okay, there we go. We solved the case.
And that's something we saw in Charles back in Major Ego too, where he really couldn't have that. He couldn't really have Tom write that article because he didn't deserve it. So it's a nice little side of Charles, I think.
Yeah. So then we find Scully getting some food in the mess tent. And Klinger says, you need to have some travel voucher. And of course, Scully's like, just stick me on the truck. Klinger's like, what do you want from me? We have a highly refined system here. She screams and I jump. Scully's like, well, Scully doesn't jump. I scream and they jump. And then I looked at Klinger as like, private? I'm a corporal. Don't make me pull rank on you.
It's
not something Klinger would ever think he would find himself saying.
And I love that he's doing this for Margaret, that he's being her wingman here.
Yep.
And I love the two of them teaming up. He's like the woman with no home and the man who is all about his home, and the woman who chooses the army and the man who does anything to get out. And I would have loved to see more of the two of them together. They are so similar in other ways too, in their dedication to their work. And maybe there's more there. It would have been wonderful to see a little bit of more Klinger-Margaret friendship storylines. Oh.
It was fun watching them, the actors, sit together at conventions. I saw them at conventions and they were sitting next to each other. And that was always so adorable, you know, sitting.
Yeah, I've seen pictures of the two of them from conventions, and oh, they're so cute. I love them so much.
Really, really, really cute. So Scully finally goes to Margaret's tent, and then we get a, you know, slightly, you know, attempt at lurid, maybe not lurid, but definitely trying to be a little sexy, and that we pan up from Margaret. She's wearing some high heels now, and we pan up over this dress. What's your opinion on the dress? What's your just opinion on how it looks?
I think it's a pretty dress, but I don't think it's a dress that Margaret would ever have chosen herself for a night on the town.
Right.
I think when we, in the earlier scene, when we see her with Klinger, there's this black and white little number hanging behind her. It seems to be one shoulder kind of thing, more form-fitted. I think that would have been something Margaret would have chosen if it had been a dress for her and not just for Scully. But yeah, the model is not for her, and not the color either. It's and the color, this peachy pink kind of thing, it's like, it's like a very, very washed out red. And that brings me all the way back to the red party, where she looks stunning in bright red. But in that episode, she talks about how she starts to feel like herself again. You know, her she's going to get a divorce,
right,
and she's getting her spirit and her confidence back. And here, she is trying to be someone else's version of what they think she should be, what Scully thinks she should be. And she is a very washed out version of that spirited and passionate woman in red. She is trying to please someone else completely. And I also got to say about the dress that Klinger did quite the job with it, because in the first scene, when you see it, that sheer fabric on top, that goes straight over her chest up against her neck. And here it's been cut open and lowered, and now it follows this little sweetheart neckline around her cleavage. And I can only imagine that that takes quite a lot of time and a lot of skill. So it was a good thing that Scully was having Five for the Road, so Klinger had time to make it perfect, really.
He's good at what he does. He's good at what he does. He should have done that when he went back home. You should have sort of opened a tailor shop or something, because that would have been,
that should have been aftermath. Come on.
yeah seriously. Scully's like, oh well, there's a Jeep waiting for me, but I think I just missed it. There's probably gonna be another one coming for a long time. And then he ruins it instantly. Scully. Because he lays on her bunk with his boots on, which is And then he's like, you know what would be fantastic? Scrounge yourselves up a hot plate. Okay, all right. And then you make a good omelet. And then she's like, okay. And he goes, you know how I like them? The real Italian sausage. We'll try and find some. And she's like, I try and stay away from sausage because, you know, I'm trying to watch my weight. And he says, you don't want to start letting out that dress again. And then you can make yours without.
Yeah.
It's like, Scully, what else do you want?
Yes. And had he just said, you don't bother with that, I'll have whatever you're having, he would have been getting lucky that afternoon. I mean, my goodness. And it's, I just love that it's such a silly little thing as imaginary omelets that really sinks this whole ship. It's just so typical. Ugh.
It's like he's not even, he's already kind of moved, like he's already assumed the sale. That it's like, okay, Margaret and I are going to now have a bunch of sex, but now I've moved past. I'm already thinking about the meal we're having after the sex. Like, Scully, let's just do the sex first. Let's just, let's just do that. And then we'll worry about a meal. And like, where do you think there's a restaurant at the 477th, Scully? Where do you think we're getting an eggs for an omelet?
And sausages, and maybe it's in the same place where he assumed that she had bought a sexy little dress for him. You know, the convenience down the road. Oh, he's being such a jerk here. And oh, his line here about showing her what counts and what doesn't after he gets her dress off. My goodness. And I know that we are so many people all over the world who have had a Scully in our lives who think that they will change us and snap us out of whatever it is. And for me personally, I'm an ever-ace woman. I have no interest in romance or sex, and most of the people in my life have been very cool about it. But I have come across some guys who would not accept that. And they've told me that, you're not asexual. You just haven't had good sex yet. But if you sleep with me, I will fix you. And that is and disrespectful. And I just despise Scully so much in this moment for saying this.
I'm sorry you've ever had to hear that. That's disgraceful. That's just disgraceful. Come on, you know. I watched this episode and I feel good about myself because I famously have no game. My game is that I have no game and I just have bumbled my way into different relationships. And luckily I've met a wonderful woman and now we're married. But I feel like I am Warren Beatty compared to Scully here. I mean, this guy is so bad at knowing, like paying attention to who he's talking to. And I guess that's kind of the reveal of the episode is that he's not really talking to Margaret. He's talking to this image of Margaret because he's not really listening to what she says or what she wants. And there's a very telling line where she gets up and she pours the wine back in the bottle. And then she says, I dress myself up in this costume for you. It's and all costume. You want is more. Referring to it as a costume is, of course, very derogatory, not a knocking the outfit or clinger or whatever, but just saying this is how foreign this feels to her. This is this isn't even a fancy outfit. This is a costume. And most people don't wear costumes when they want to be comfortable. It's Halloween or it's whatever. It's a very that's very revealing to Margaret that's how she feels in this thing, that it's so alien to who she is. She's going to love the equal rights movement and coming in the late 60s. She's going to absolutely love it. Margaret, pants. Pants.
Oh my God. She looks so good in a pair of slacks. I mean, come on.
I mean, Catherine Hepburn is already famous by this point.
Oh my God. A couple of capri pants. Oh my goodness. She's going to rock that in a couple of years.
She's going to crush it. And then she's like, no recognition for what I've done. Any way to special please you. And he's just, you know, he's just sort of clueless a little. He tries to listen a little and he's like, I've gotten used to giving orders, which is, you know, come on.
Of course and he only appreciates the dress in the sense that he wants it to come off, you know, and Margaret wants him to appreciate the effort it took for her to put it on and what the gesture means. And I think that is also something very relevant in regards of her father, actually, and in their relationship, because she wants him to acknowledge the effort too and everything she has done to please him when it comes to her career and her rank. But it's impossible, and I bet it's been that way always. I can imagine a younger Margaret coming home telling her father that, "Hey, I'm in the top 10% of my class," and he would just go, "Well, then 5% is right within reach," you know, and never really acknowledging the effort she has made. And I think she must be just so tired of trying and at this point in so many aspects of her life and just get nothing in return.
Yeah, it's tough. It's really, really tough. That's, I mean, not to, all right, I don't want to go down this road or whatever, but I'm thinking of it, of like the idea of the constant kind of like, well, then the next thing. And that's an interesting observation about what her father might do. It's because it's like, I've been a creative person my whole life. I went to art school. I wanted to be an artist, and I was for a long time or whatever. But like, I've done lots of ventures that don't make me money because they fulfill me creatively, like what we're doing right now. Yeah. And virtually every single time I've mentioned something like that to either one of my parents, their response is always, do you get paid for that? It's always that. And eventually I just stopped telling them. I've stopped telling them about any of it because they just, and I'm not, you know, oh, they're terrible people. I'm not trying to suggest that. It's just, they come from another generation where it's like, they're looking out for me and they're just like, well, can he make money doing this? And to them, it's like doing something that doesn't make you money is like, why would you buy? why would you bother to do that?
Exactly.
You know,
put all that time and effort into something that's not going to show up on your bank account. Yeah.
Yeah.
I get that. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like people, you know, why do you do all the MASH episodes? Because they're fun. Because of the conversations I'm having right now. That's why I'm doing it. That's why, I mean, I love that it's out there. That's another one. Okay. Another show's already gone on long enough, but one other side thing is like, I will, and I won't mention who has said this to me, but I've had some guests occasionally who worry that they talk too much or they, you know, that they're not being like as commercial kind of as they should be. And I've, or, you know, they're like, oh, you know, if in case people say give you negative comments about this one, don't worry about inviting me back. And I've always been like, this is, I'm the one who has to do all this.
Yeah,
this is my show. I do this for my, for the conversations I'm having.
Yeah.
That's what I do it for. Don't worry about it. Like, you know what I mean? Like, and in some level, like, I don't really care beyond that. You know, if you like this, and judging by the amount of people that kept asking me, when's the show coming back? A lot of people do like this show.
Yeah.
And it's like, but beyond that, I don't really care. And if you are like, oh, I don't like the way that person, well, then don't listen. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's kind of like.
Exactly. It's so easy. And it's so nice to have something like that in your life that just truly gives you joy, and that you do because you love it so much, and it isn't about money. And it's the same way for me when it comes to writing fan fiction. I mean, that's just a labor of love, and I love to come home from work and step into one of my stories and just be swept away by these awesome characters. And that, of course, isn't about a single dollar either. It's just about spending time with the characters you love, and if you're lucky, you get a kudos or a comment from someone out there. But it's not really about that. It's about being in a place that you love to be.
Yeah. When else am I going to talk to some charming erudite person from Sweden? When is that going to happen in my life?
Exactly.
When you know,
just don't come along every day.
thanks, MASH. Appreciate it. So there's a great turn of phrase where they kind of talk about where she's like, you know, what do you think I am deep down? And he's like, a woman. And then she's like, dig a little deeper. And he says, a major. And she's like, no, I'm a nurse. And she's like, I'm all those things. And he says, sounds like it's awful crowded in there. And she's like, sometimes it's awful lonely in there, which is great, you know, great back and forth. And then, so you know, great. He says, well, I'm used to a certain chain of command with me in command and me in chains, which maybe a little too clever, just a smidge, a little too like, all right, would you guys all have this? But okay, you know, whatever.
Yeah,
it's fine.
We'll allow it.
We'll allow it. It's fine.
Yeah. And I really love how quiet and calm this last conversation between them is. You know, when she broke up with Frank, he tore a door off and lost his mind, and McDonald, it was yelling over the phone, and this is so very still. She doesn't get mad, she just gets tired and resigned. And you know, I see you want me in chains in this little box. You want a version of me that you can handle, and I'm not going to settle for that. So it's over. And he realizes it too. And just, he doesn't try and push.
Yeah. They're just not a good fit. That's it. Sometimes it's just the sad realization. You're just not a good, you may have thought you were at the beginning, but you're just not a good fit.
It was a bad romance.
Yeah. My wife jokes with me all the time that, cause I'm sort of mockingly frustrated that all the women in my life are just so headstrong and difficult to deal with, whether it be my wife or my dog or my sister. And she's like, well, you're attracting these women. So what is it?
What's up with you?
I'm like, I guess so. She's like, you must like it because they're all the women in your life are that way. I'm like, fair point.
If you dig down deep, maybe you like it.
I love this
last part of the episode when he leaves, and I always expect her to just pick up a glass and go, here's to me, like she does.
You think that's the thing? No, that's the other episode, right?
And
it's such
a nice echo of that scene, because you know, Margaret turns away from a man who wants something from her that she is no longer willing to give, of her body and her mind, and she didn't want to play games with a general, and she doesn't want to play any with Scully, and she will not shrink herself down to and play a role that she's not comfortable with anymore. And it's a great moment. I really love it. And also, I forgot to mention the pearl necklace that she's wearing. Do you think those are the real pearls that she conned out of Frank?
Oh, I forgot about those. Yeah, let's say they are. Yes. He's held on to them all these years. Yeah. I forgot all about the cut. Those early seasons feel like 1,000 years ago, don't they? Right? When you look at the show and how it's evolved, you're like, my God, this feels so long ago. So anyway, that's our main show end. And then we come back and Hawkeye is still playing Scrabble, presumably maybe with Igor, maybe by himself, but he's there all by himself. Again, the Oak Club's kind of dead. I don't know what everybody's, what everybody else is doing. The Oak Club's usually a little busier than this.
It's weird because it was apparently a lull and people were bored. So wouldn't they be in there and party? I don't know.
I would be at the pinball machine nonstop. Although I don't know if the pinball machine is here just yet. I think they put that later on, put in later.
Yeah,
on.
I think that comes later. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, Margaret comes in and they sit down and she has a great line where she's like, that torch went out. She goes, I could have a bonfire if I didn't just keep running into guys who just wanted to get their hands warm, which is a
great
phrase. And then they have this really nice conversation. Well, someday you'll meet the Mr. Right. Well, the latest Mr. Right just left.
Yeah.
I have the only heart in Korea with a revolving door. There's just one. They're just rolling off her tongue here. Like, yeah. Just boom, 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 boom. And then she's kind of going into Margaretdom where she's like, I only going to meet men unless they meet the minimum standard requirement.
No more, buddy-o.
She's being very Margaret. She's drinking from a bottle. I will never not notice that now after the story.
Isn't she the coolest? And she has two beers. That is like double super cool.
I will always be thinking of young Marie Kay drinking from a bottle when I see these episodes now. That will forever lock to my memory. So then she does the rundown where she says, I want 20% of my father, 10% of Scully, about 10% of you. Which is a very nice compliment, and he takes it that way. He's like, oh, thank you, you know. 3% of Frank Burns, which, in my estimation, too high. That's too high a percentage for Frank Burns.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out what the percentage were really here with Frank. I think Margaret is really into the Frank that we see in Margaret's engagement when he comes to her tent and talks about lawnmowers and kids
with straight white teeth
and striped t-shirts and whatever it is, and she looks all dreamy, I think she's very into that Frank that she sort of project pictures onto of a true patriot and a brave and talented doctor. And I also gotta say with Frank that Margaret and Frank match each other's freak spectacularly. And I just think, you know, Margaret may be tired of playing games and roles in some ways, but in other ways, I think she is kind of into it. And the games that she played with Frank, you know, traveling stocking salesman and bored housewife or whatever they were into that week, I think she enjoyed that. And also that Frank had his raw lust for her, and he just always wanted her. And I think she was very into that sort of unbridled sexuality between them. She loves to be wanted, and maybe that is a side of him that she remembers fondly.
I think their dynamic, not to be sordid, but I think in their dynamic, she got to do stuff to Frank that other men might not put up. Would be so, okay with.
I think she was more the dominant part.
A little bit. Little bit.
In several ways. Yeah.
A lot of crazy stuff went on in those early seasons. And I know Absolutely. That like I know that they don't want to turn this speech into like a 20 because it's the bumper. They don't have a lot of time. But I think if she was doing the breakdowns, I think BJ would have like a good chunk in there.
That's
right?
True.
I think he'd be like a 25% because I think to Margaret, I think BJ has all the qualities of Hawkeye, but none of the deficits of Hawkeye in her mind.
Yeah.
Right? He's warm. He's loyal. He's obviously deeply devoted to his wife. He's got a lot of heart. He's very intelligent. He's a top flight surgeon. Like, she wants to meet a BJ. She absolutely not the malcontent version. That's the part she doesn't. But yeah, I think if you said to if you you know, fan fiction to this, just, you know, hint, yeah. hint, she would say, oh, 25% BJ Honeycutt at least, I would say, because I think he's just like, you know,
yeah,
she respects his skills and all that other kind of stuff. So
cute. And she respects, she really into his loyalty and his talent as a surgeon. So absolutely. It's kind of weird that he isn't in there. It's, and I would also have expected maybe a bigger percentage of her father in there. And I think that maybe early season Margaret would have said like 50% my father or something. But, you know, I think she is into his dedication and his sacrifices. And also maybe with her father, it's sort of the image she can project onto him. And he represents the army to her in a way. And the same way with Scully, it's just in another way. With him, he is more of the foot soldier on the ground, and she would love to see him with more stripes on his shirt, but he represents this scrappy soldier coming in directly from the front line, and that is just, I think that's sexy to her, really.
Yeah. Hawkeye gets the Scrabble board, and they're talking about, you know, we're both looking for custom fits on an off the rack world. And he says, you ever play double solitaire Scrabble? And she's like, what that? And he says, you make whatever you can out of what you got. I'm making whatever I got. And, you know, if we don't score off each other, and if you need extra letters, like Y for sympathy, you can borrow one of mine. He's being very, very sweet. And she's, what if I find love? You win the game. And then she looks at her, her peg or tablets or whatever. And she goes, hark, Nerf.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I keep looking. And that's the end of our episode. And very sweet.
And not one of those letters are L, O, V, or E.
Oh, right,
it's
right.
So nice. And you can spell Frank with those letters, though. So that's something. I just love this whole little exchange between them. It's just they have come so far at this point, so they can just sit together and be sweet and kind and friendly and supportive, and for Margaret to be able to open up and admit that something is wrong. That's pretty huge for her, and also, and for him to offer her a why for sympathy. That's pretty huge. I mean, early Hawkeye would never. He would offer her a big D, if anything, if you get what I mean.
I think I got it. You know what? I know that Ken Levine, MASH writer Ken Levine, famously said that he was never in support of Hawkeye and Margaret sleeping together, because he said you can't unring that bell after that, because you can't always ever undo it, and it's always going to be kind of in the background of the characters. And while I understand that point of view, and I even agree with it to a certain extent, I think scenes like this, episodes like this, where you get them being chummy with one another, the fact that they have been together once, I think only sweetens this, because they are friends that have had intimacy, but they know this is never going to work. But they have that understanding that only people that have been intimate with one another can really So I think in that case, those episodes make these conversations a little bit more rich than if they never had.
I completely agree. It matters that they have this history together, actually. And I think that, you know, they are at a point in their life now that they're like, we slept together. It was what it was, but it was so great for our friendship, you know, and I really love that. And as I mentioned, little young me watching MASH once upon a time was really into the idea of Hawkeye and Margaret getting together. I really wanted them to couple up for real. But adult, smart me is very happy that they never did, because relationships like this on TV with male and female friendships, those are just so incredibly important to me. And the fact that they can be supportive to each other, and that they can be there in need, and they can also, you know, call each other out when that is needed, and just put their foot down, and they can handle each other. And I think that is part of what the 10% of Hawkeye Margaret wants. You know, she is really into his passion and his dedication and his humor sometimes when it isn't annoying her. But I think that Margaret before Korea was a lot like Hawkeye, actually. I think she was, she was a party girl, and both of them like to be around people and have affairs, and they are basically the same person, but also the complete opposite, and that makes them so interesting to me. They see themselves in each other, and that both attracts them and repels them, and there's always this push and pull between them that I think they both find intriguing. I don't think they've come across that before. Yeah, it's just I'm glad that Comrades in Arms happened. Actually, I think I have some issues with how that whole thing turned out in
Yeah, the
Comrades in Arms
execution of
Part
it.
Two.
Yeah.
But yeah, but the fact that they did hook up really meant something for them, and it's obvious in scenes like this. And as much as I am happy that they never coupled up on the show, I will say that again, I am a fanfic writer, and I may have written some stories where they actually do get together after Korea, but that is a whole other story because they are completely different people then.
I would imagine their differences would be less so out of the army context because Hawkeye's no
Yes.
longer the malcontent fighting against the system in that regard, you
Exactly.
know?
And
So.
they have their backpacks and baggage and traumas, and I think they somewhere along the line they could really be helpful for each other in other ways than just friendly, perhaps.
If I may indulge in some fan fiction in my brain that I'm popping off in my brain right
Yes.
now, after the war, Margaret visits Hawkeye in Crabapple Cove and is utterly charmed by Hawkeye in a new way because she's going to see him about like how he is respected in the town as the preeminent physician. And then also she's probably going to love Hawkeye's dad,
Oh my
right? Because
God,
she's,
have you read my stories? Because that's basically what I've been written.
Right?
What
Because
I've
if she
been
loves Colonel
writing.
Potter, if Colonel Potter
Yes.
is the surrogate dad, he's everything her dad is, except
Yes.
he's not such a hard ass, then
Yes.
right, then Daniel Pierce is probably the even better, like seeing Hawkeye through that prism of like how much his dad loves his son. Like
Yes.
we know that Daniel Pierce loves his son so much, and it's like they're such pals. That Margaret is probably like, oh
Absolutely.
my God, I'm seeing Hawkeye in a whole new way because now here he's not the angry malcontent. He's the respected physician in this small town that everyone loves because he's such a great doctor.
Exactly. Seeing him in that setting and with his father. Yes, that has been a theme in several of my stories. And I love Daniel Pierce so much. He's one of my favorite MASH characters that we actually never see, but
Never
still,
see or hear.
I love him so much, and it's just, yeah, that is for sure a road I see Margaret and Hawkeye going after
All
the
right. Well, Marie, I will tell you something as we're getting to the end of. You know what? Let's do the favorite lines. I forgot to do favorite line. What's your favorite line or joke from this
yes.
episode?
I have chosen, you'll notice these leaves come in gold, not pink for girls and blue for boys. That is my favorite. I just think it captures so much of Margaret at this point, how she just wants to be taken seriously, and she wants simple respect for her accomplishments, and she doesn't want to be seen as just a silly woman with silly ambitions. She is as much a major as any other major, and as much a woman as any other woman, and she is damn good at both of them, while also being the coolest when drinking beer from a bottle.
My favorite line is when Potter is berating BJ in Winchester and he's like, what about Walter Reed? What about this? And then and Hawkeye starts saying, what about the evac guy? Blah, 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 blah. And then Potter turns to Hawkeye and says, and what about you? You took extra patience so those two could double up their time on Hauser. And then Hawkeye in that mock modesty goes, I was just being indispensable. He's so yes, you're right. What about
So
me? You know,
great.
he was just really enjoying that.
Oh, that's a great one.
I do like that. One other observation I have in this episode is that when I was doing the notes for it and plugging in titles on my Excel spreadsheet and yada yada, I always think this episode is called Stars and Stripe singular
Oh,
because
okay.
it's the stripe on his shirt, right? It's the bit
All
the
right.
the And it's not. It's called Stars and Stripes because it, and it doesn't really
Yes.
matter because obviously it's a reference to the newspaper and the fact that his stripes change it's not that Stripes is a worse title, but my brain will never, and I would keep putting in Stars and Stripes, and then I would go back and I'd go, oh no, that's wrong, and I kept taking the S out in my file, and I'm like, no, it's called Stars and Stripes. Again, I don't know why my brain will not allow myself to remember that, but anyway, just a look. When else am I going to mention such a thing? So what I was going to say before I forgot about the favorite lines, Marie, is I have another recording scheduled today, not a MASHcast. I'm doing something else. But when I was booking all of my records, I was kind of decided, because you and I had this booked first before I was booking the other thing, because my wife is away right now. So I was like, I might as well just sit and record a bunch of podcasts, get them all done. So while I'm doing that, I'm trying to decide, well, what time should I ask that person to be ready? So I'm like, well, okay, when will I be done with Marie? And I initially said, you know what? Better give that one some time. So I blocked out a bunch of time.
That. Thank you so much for that. Because I truly appreciate that.
We are at the 2-hour mark on a relatively random episode.
I did not expect that. I am kind of surprised. And I also have some notes left. I can send them to you. You can just go through them.
Okay. Before we sign off, give us one more note. Just pull one more note out of your notes that you didn't get to.
Oh my goodness. Let's see here. We can talk about, I can mention how one of the reasons that I like this episode is that there are no high stakes in this episode when it comes to wounded and CMC the OR, but it's still such a great storytelling. And I think that so many more modern shows are all about the spectacle, and the writing is so on the nose, where the characters are spelling out the plot and what they're doing and what they're thinking, so people can just be scrolling on their phones while they have the show on in the background. But the writers of MASH, they trust us in the audience, and they give us episodes like this that are all about character development and great acting, and I truly appreciate this thing about the episode. And it was obviously enough to talk about for almost 2 hours. My goodness.
That's why we have you on, Marie. It's why we have you on. I want people to talk. As much as I love hearing the sound of my own friggin' voice, obviously, I want people to talk. So absolutely. That's always a pleasure to have you on. I look forward I'm sorry that we didn't get to have you on earlier. I would have loved to have talked to you about season 4, 5 6 episodes, but at least you're here now. I can't wait to have you back next season. So thank you so much for doing this again.
Thank you so much for having me back. I had such a good time. Thank you.
All right. So thank you all for listening. Of course, you can find all the back episodes on our website, findwaterpodcast.com. I'm on Blue Sky under Rob Kelly Creative. And then if you want to support MASHcast, please just go to patreon.com/FW podcasts. And one of the rewards you can get there is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So a big salute to Dennis Bailey, Daryl Clark, James K, Michael Kelly, David Mann, Matt McLean, Lisa P, Brady Palmer, Joe Perino, Stan Peel, Michael Porter, Nicholas Prom, Adam Sanders, Stefan Van Schaik, Britt Schramm, Billy Schumann, and Mike Thomas. I really do appreciate it. So we will see you all next week. But until then, that is all.
Sergeant, how long has it been since you had your shots records checked?
It's been too long, I'm sure.
Well, you better get to it then. This would be a terrible time for this man to come down with a case of lockjaw.